So, I look forward to your questions or connections that you want to make. Yes.
I guess this is more of a connection than a question. Okay. Have you read any of Bill Plotkin's work on soul and nature?
The name again?
Bill Plotkin.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. And his movement that he has, training.
I think it really fits in a good deal with what you're saying. And I know it fit in a good deal with, I've lived a lot in nature and spent a lot of time outdoors and felt much closer, felt the connection coming through both sides. Left brain and right brain came together after I read this book.
Sure.
And it put me in my nature walks. Mm-hmm. It made them all the more meaningful. Mm-hmm. For instance, having a butterfly sit on my hand for 10 minutes. I just blessed that butterfly for spending 10 whole minutes of its tiny life exploring the back of my hand. It gave me a chance to study the intricate and amazingly beautiful pattern on its wings that would fold and unfold. And in the meantime, it was studying me.
Of course.
probing in every pore, looking for what, or telling me what. And it wasn't until another butterfly came and lured it away that it left. I was wondering, shall I take it home with me very gingerly on the back of my head? And this all fit in with these marvelous books, Soulcraft, and what was the latest book is a very long book. Takes a long time to read, but it sort of combines all his books in one. I'm sort of recommending that to anybody who wants to feel the completeness of creation. It's easy to do.
Thank you. Yes. Bill Everson, the California poet, says that most people experience God in nature or experience God not at all. And he says the God-hungry person, the God-thirsty person, experiences God everywhere. And because the word logos is everywhere. You see, the cosmic Christ is in every butterfly and in every forest. And that's why, of course, as species disappear, and of course they're disappearing at the greatest rate in the last 65 million years since the dinosaurs disappeared, as species disappear, the Christ is being crucified all over again. That's the shadow side to realizing that the cosmic Christ is the light in every being. It's also the wounds in every being. So the Roman Empire was not the only empire that crucified the Christ.
I appreciate very much what you've said about the cosmic Christ, in particular about the focus on nature. This is probably a curiosity question, but how did you go about forgiving Ratzinger?
Well, I think writing my book, The Pope's War, where I told the truth about him, and I got more into his own background, that his father was a bully, a policeman who, curiously, they moved almost every 1 or 2 years from one small town to another in Bavaria. Must have been a reason for this. And also, he had a brother, Ratzinger, who was also a priest and was also a bully. His brother has admitted that he physically abused his choir members. He had a boys' choir that he ran. And there was also sexual abuse. He says he wasn't part of that. Okay, maybe we'll believe him. But he admitted that he did physically abuse these boys as a full-grown priest, full-grown man. So clearly there was a lineage of bullying, and Ratzinger is a bully. Now, in the introduction, you were referring to the first version of that book, the 92 Silence Theologians, but the paperback version that came out the next year, there were then 105. And it's not just about silencing theologians. First of all, many of these theologians they silenced and abused died of heart attacks. Or starvation. You know, you lose your profession, literally, especially in the third world. And But what they really were doing was threatening. They were telling people not to think. And there's a direct link between that and their hiring yes men to be bishops and cardinals and archbishops. And that's why there was a pedophile cover-up. Because you had people without conscience and without much intelligence running things. But they were hired only because they were yes men. And so, you know, you have to, like I said earlier, you have to go to the full depths of the implications of what went on. But the real scandal is not just Ratzinger himself, but how he climbed to the top of the biggest religious organization in the world. That's really scary. And that, in my opinion, it reawakens the whole issue of evil and how evil so often wins and attracts power and goes to where the power is. So, for example, the fact that the Supreme Court has six radical right-wing Catholics on it, all of whom voted for the, except, of course, for Justice Sotomayor, all of whom voted, and she's not right-wing Catholic, she's just a Catholic. But these five guys voted for Citizens United, telling us that corporations are people, and then the Hobby Lobby. It's crazy. And it's only understandable, I think, in the context of realizing how smart evil is. Evil goes to where the power is. In my post-war book, I demonstrate, it's footnoted completely, 2 months after Reagan was sworn in as president, in the month of March, they held, the National Security Council held a gathering in Santa Fe with one question, a two-week seminar, how can we destroy liberation theology in Latin America? And they concluded we cannot destroy it, we can split the church. And they went after John Paul II. The head of CIA, Jim Casey, was an extreme right-wing Catholic, probably Opus Dei. He made 29 trips to the Vatican with satchels full of cash. Gave it to the Pope for solidarity. In exchange, the Pope went after liberation theology and base communities in Latin America. I've been told by a very knowledgeable priest about Latin America that Pope John Paul II killed at least 10,000 people in Latin America by his supporting that kind of abuse. So it's a system. And that's why I said earlier, you don't forgive the system. You work to tell the truth and replace it and clean it. Ratzinger is a footnote in history. He will be remembered as the chief inquisitor. And John Paul II appointed him to bring the inquisitor back. That's what history will remember them for. Killing theology in the Catholic Church, and with it, all these other scandals that have bubbled up. So, but the good news in my writing that book to try to cleanse my relationship with the Catholic Church was how it ended. And I didn't know it was going to end this way. That I came to the conclusion that the Holy Spirit did this, really. That we had two schismatic popes in 34 years to destroy the Catholic Church as we know it. Because I don't think the Holy Spirit wants it around anymore in its present structure. It's over. Push the restart button. We go back to Jesus and to the prophets and the mystics, including Eckhart and all these other great ones, Hildegard and so many others, and become our own mystics and prophets. That's what the Christian Church should be about. And so I think it's deliberate. It's the end of an era. And I pray for this Pope. I wish him well. In my little book, Letters to Pope Francis, I propose this, for example, that he go on a speaking tour with the Dalai Lama around the world. Five continents, five issues. A new economics, education, we have to reinvent education, women, youth, and ecology. Those are the five big issues of our time. The two of them together would be terrific, tag team. And they'd get the press's attention. And that would put wind in the sails of the ground roots where there are so many good people trying to get these things done. And I mentioned this in Claremont where I was lecturing a few months ago. This man came up, he said, I'm Tibetan. I'm the Dalai Lama's right-hand man in North America. He said, there'll be no problem convincing him of this. I'll take it to him. But he said, you know, the last Pope, he said, we wrote him a letter and suggested something like that, and he never wrote us back. I said, congratulations. Count your blessings. The last guy you'd want to travel with is Cardinal Ratzinger, who tells Christians that they should not do yoga because it gets them too much in touch with their body, and who says that Protestants are not Christian churches. So, you know, you didn't want to travel with Ratzinger anyway. But this guy, he would make a good traveling companion, and you'd learn from each other. But I do say that, you know, well, I have hope that this guy is doing good work already with his office. I don't see much chance at all that he's going to change the system, because the system for 34 years has been appointing people without conscience and intelligence. And some of these crazy people, like the bishop of San Francisco, where I live, Opus Dei to the extreme. He can't talk to anyone except a right-wing Catholic. The bishop in Minnesota. I was just at a conference in Colorado, and there were people from Minnesota, and they were just going on and on about how utterly crazy he is. This Opus Dei bishop in Kansas City, who should be in jail, should be in prison, because he supported an abusive priest deliberately, consciously, just a few years ago, etc., etc. I mean, the whole scene is filled with sick human beings. And so this Pope has no middle management to help him. And so, don't put a lot of energy into Popes, even good ones. You know, take it back to your level of responsibility.
Which is exactly what I want to ask you about, how women can develop our masculine side. So now that we have understood and filled out well our job of embracing and compassion with the world, how, developing our masculine side, can we take this out then?
Well, again, I, in all humility, recommend my book on the hidden spirituality of men, because these archetypes belong to all of us, women and men. And see, the thing about an archetype is that it's older than any culture, particular culture, or religious lineage. So there's so much here that you can play with as women. The way I most like to teach the sacred masculine is to get people to create skits about the green man, or about the blue man, or about Father Sky. But first, kind of read a chapter, and then so you get more into it. And then, but to create a skit simply, you know, quickly, not elaborately, say take 10 or 15 minutes. But you get these then into your consciousness, and of course, it's play to put on a little skit. And that's a very deep way to learn, and it's fun. But it's profound. I remember the first time I did that, when the book first came out, was at CIIS in San Francisco on an all-day Saturday workshop. There were men and women in the group. And 3 months later, I ran into a woman in the supermarket. She said, I was in that one-day workshop on the sacred masculine. She said, it changed my life. So, absolutely. And, you know, women, let's face it, women are so much more eager to break new ground and take risks. Some men are, but percentage-wise, women are. And so women, in a way, have to be leaders even in this sacred masculine recovery. Because there was a men's movement, and it helped some men, but it didn't go nearly as far or as deep as it needed to go. So we need this new, we need a new men's movement. But we need the women, I think, to do exactly what you're talking about, coming to grips also with the sacred masculine. And, of course, this is that warrior energy. And remember that the difference between a soldier and a warrior. The soldier is given a gun and told, kill or be killed. That's the assignment. It's very clear. The warrior does one's inner work. The warrior, Hafiz, the great Sufi mystic, says the warrior is a lover. He says that only when you and God become sweet lovers can you carry your heart through the world like a life-giving sun, S-U-N. So the warrior deals with the hooves of the past and with the fear of the future, the ghosts of the future, that Hafiz says want to come in and barf everywhere. So, of course, all fear is about the future. So that's why it takes warrior energy to stand up to fear. So finding spiritual practices that work for you, that give you a stronger heart. Courage is two French words. Cœur, large, a big heart. What expands your heart and makes you stronger? Buck Ghostoris is a Lakota teacher who is very important to me. And he taught me once, he said that in our tradition, fear is a door in the heart that lets evil spirits in. So all real prayer, he says, is strengthening your heart so that fear cannot come into the door and drag other spirits with it. So that's warrior energy. And women as well as men are called to that. And knowing what I know about women, I think a higher percentage of women will get it at this time in history. And of course, to support those women and those men who know something about these things. Let me talk a bit about courage, because courage is so important for me, being a spiritual theologian and at 73 and a half years old. I've come to the conclusion that the number one sign of spirit is courage. So I look for courage. And I'll tell you a couple stories. One is Sister Dorothy Stang. How many of you have heard her story? Great. She was in my master's program up in Oakland. And she was a sister of Notre Dame de Namur. And she was a missionary in the Amazon. And make a long story short, she knew she was under... being watched. But she went back anyway, and one day she was murdered there by hired assassins because she was supporting the peasants in the struggle against the plantation owners and the rainforest as well. And she's buried there now. In fact, a peasant said on the day of the burial, "We are not burying you, Sister Dorothy, we are planting you." I think it's very beautiful. They're making a movie of her story now, and Glenn Close is going to play Sister Dot. They're still raising some money, but I read the script, and it's a good script. Though I had a few comments on the proposal. But it's a woman of courage. And she was also a woman of laughter. Now, her brothers, who are ex-priests, one lives in L.A., told me that when she did our program, she was a different woman afterwards. She got much more into her body and into her sexuality. It made her much stronger. And that creation spirituality really gave her her strength and her warriorhood. So you want to remember that where do you find your strength? And like someone just spoke about finding it in nature. Someone else told me she just came back from a retreat in nature. So, and of course, here you live in a very special area of the world, obviously. So this just isn't just for your delight. It's also for your strength. Now, another example of courage, Fred Shuttlesworth. He was an African-American minister who marched with King. He was in Birmingham. And he, unlike King, was not middle class. He didn't have a lot of education. He was a street priest, a street minister. But he was beaten with chains three times by the Ku Klux Klan. They arrested his two children, 8 and 10. Sheriff Bull O'Connor arrested his kids to threaten him, and they blew up his house and he was in it, but he walked out alive. Several years, he's now deceased. He died just a year or two ago in his 80s. But a few years ago I was invited to do a dialogue with him in Birmingham at the Civil Rights Museum, which is right across the street from that African Methodist church that was blown up on the Sunday morning where 6 girls died. And the topic was ecology and racism that we were going to dialogue on. So just before we started, he and I were having a simple lunch together, and I asked him, he said, "Fred, where do you get your courage?" And this was his answer. He said, "Well, you can call it courage if you want, but I don't. I call it trust." He said, "When they blew up my house and I walked out alive, I knew they couldn't kill me, and they couldn't kill the movement. Or they might one day kill my body, but they could not kill me or the movement." To me, that's a profound lesson from a guy who knows what he's talking about. Courage is trust. What do you learn to trust in this world? Do you trust the universe? Do you trust spirit? And we grow out of things. Like Joe Campbell used to say, none of us lives a life we had intended. So, you know, you may have begun trusting institutional religion. Maybe you've moved a little beyond that. But we do have to know what we trust, because that is where courage comes from. What do we really believe in? And then, trust, you know, is a real word for faith. In the New Testament, pistuein doesn't mean here's 22 doctrines to memorize and believe in. It means trust. When Jesus says, go your way, your trust has healed you, your faith has healed you, he really is saying your trust has healed you. So that question of trust is very profound. And that's where courage comes from also. And of course, learn from the ancestors. That's why I love bringing Hildegard forward and Eckhart forward and these great beings who also had a lot of struggle in their life and a lot of opposition. They too are models of courage. And you call on them too. You call on them. They are our ancestors. They care. They want to be involved and give us strength.
I'm so overwhelmed by the today. But do you think these angels that are out there are really trying to communicate with us one way or another to help us along with our struggle?
I don't think they are. I know they are. Absolutely. I know a lot of people who've had angelic help, a lot of wonderful people. And again, they're there to help. Aquinas says angels cannot help but love. He also says angels carry thoughts from prophet to prophet. I love that image. I see a bee carrying pollen from flower to flower. So, don't underestimate. You see, I did a book with Rupert Sheldrake on angels. In fact, it's just come out, a new edition with a new preface, and we have Lorna Byrne in the preface. I don't know if they have that here, but it's available. Do you have the book on angels? Or maybe it's sold out there. Anyway, it's a really good book, because it's the first book in maybe ever, certainly in the last 300 years, where a scientist and a theologian are daring to talk about angels. And Rupert is such a creative scientist. And he asks some really interesting questions, like, if angels are busy leading the course of evolution, you know, Charles Darwin had a partner who didn't get any of the press that Darwin did. His partner was named Wallace, a natural scientist like Darwin. And they split over this one issue. Darwin said it's just chance, blind chance evolution. And Wallace said it's intelligences, therefore angels, who guide evolution. And that's in our dialogues, among other things. But notice then, let's say the angels were involved in the evolution of the dinosaur. But when the dinosaur goes extinct, what do those angels do? Are they unemployed? You know, what are they doing now, you see? So there's some really interesting questions that today's science can raise about angels. But that angels happen, that people have experience of angels, this is for real. So our book is called The Physics of Angels. And you can learn more there. What we do, we take three important thinkers, Hildegard, section on her, what she says about angels, section on what Aquinas says about angels, and a section what Denis Areopagite, the 16th century Syrian monk, wrote about angels. Those are the three biggest teachers of angels in the Western tradition. And they have a lot to say. And one thing is this blew my mind. Rupert says, when Aquinas is talking about angels, you could substitute the word photons in today's physics, and you'd have the same answers. Because he talks at what speed, he talks about the speed of light that angels travel, and all these questions that science is talking about photons. So that just blew my mind. And once again, it shows you our ancestors were not dumb. Many of their interpreters have been. And especially when they get used as bludgeons for orthodoxy, then you lose all the energy and power and wisdom that's there. But when it comes to Aquinas, remember, he was condemned 3 times by the bishops before he was canonized a saint. So he must have said something interesting and probably very truthful. And he did. And the very fact that he salivated after science, that his whole life was bringing Aristotle into Christianity, and Aristotle being the best scientist they could find in the 13th century, that itself is of immense importance. Aquinas says a mistake about creation results in a mistake about God. So we need scientists to tell us what nature's about, what creation's about. Let me tell you a little story. I guess I have to quit real soon, but let me close with this story. I was in South Korea lecturing a month or two ago, and I was really impressed. I did not expect this. The church in South Korea is very alive, and there's an intellectual life there. There's a real curiosity. It's really interesting. And I was in Seoul. One of my talks was at Seoul, and it was actually in a Catholic institution. That's another thing. Also in the South, I spoke at a Catholic university. Here in America, I'm radioactive, a Catholic. Can't touch me, but there I was, priests, nuns, a whole bit. But I was in Seoul, 600 people in the room, standing room only, sitting on the floors, a lot of young people. And the very last question, they went for 3 hours because I had a translator, you know, translating every sentence has been long. So, you know, that kind of doubles the time. But the very last question, a young man stood up, 26. He said, "I am gay." And he said, "I don't feel welcome in the church here in Korea." Well, so I lapsed into my whole pitch on gay. First of all, that it's a Galileo question of our time, because science has spoken, and religion, some religions, churches, still have their heads in the sand like they did with Galileo. Science has spoken. 8 to 10% of any given human population anywhere is going to be gay, and we've counted 464 other species that have gay populations. So gay is not unnatural except for heterosexuals. And of course, heterosexuality is unnatural for homosexuals, so get over it. And secondly, I said, my Bible says God is love. It doesn't say God is heterosexual love. And then I quoted Jose Habde, the Franciscan Seneca woman, who told me years ago, she said, in our tradition, people who really know our tradition know that every spiritual director to every great chief in the country was gay. We know that gay people carry more spiritual depth than others, and that's their role in community. And so I went on and on a bit, and then I ended with this sentence. I said, so any church or society that worships a homophobic God is depriving itself of its own spiritual energy. And how smart is that? That was my last word. Then it was over, and immediately my translator, who was a really neat woman in her 30s, who I really liked, she disappeared. And I had to sign books and to all these Koreans without having a translator. That was weird. But immediately, the guy who was leading the day rushed up to the podium. He said, "You've dropped a bomb, a huge bomb." He said, "South Korea is the most homophobic place in the world." Now, he said, "This is a good bomb. Someone had to drop it, and it had to be an outsider. But you dropped a bomb." Well, I had no idea. I didn't know I was in the most homophobic culture in the world. But so the next morning, I was traveling south on a train with the translator, and she told me the story. She said, "I'm lesbian." She said, "I could barely get through your translating because what you were talking about took the top of my head off." The top, and I, when you finished, I ran to the laboratory and cried for an hour, she said. You know, so, you know, it's no small thing to just get honest once in a while and tell the truth. And science has spoken. You know, Ratzinger put out 2 ugly documents against gay people. There's not one quote to any scientific document. There's quotes to his catechism, but not to any science. That's the Galileo thing all over again. Let me close with a beautiful teaching from Howard Thurman, one of my favorite creation mystics. Howard Thurman, as you probably know, is an African-American spiritual genius who was the spiritual genius behind the civil rights movement. When King was stabbed in 1958 in New York, he asked for one person, Howard Thurman, to be at his bedside. And Howard Thurman, who lived in San Francisco the last years of his life with his wife, the Church of the Fellowship of All Peoples. When King went to jail, he took one book with him every single time. 39 times King went to jail, he took one book, Howard Thurman's book, Jesus and the disinherited. So that's how close King was spiritually to Howard Thurman. Here's Howard Thurman. I think this is so prophetic. Man builds his little shelter. He raises his little wall. Man builds his little altar. He worships his little God. Man organizes the resources of his little life. He defends his little barrier. All this to no avail. What man is committed to in the religious experience, which is the insight of these pages, is this: the effective possibility of a vital religious fellowship, which is so creative in character, so convincing in quality, that it inspires the mind to multiply experiences of unity. Multiply experiences of unity. That's your mystical experiences. By the way, when he was a young man, 19 years old, Howard Thurman studied with the Quaker Rufus Jones, who taught him Meister Eckhart and Francis of Assisi. So Eckhart is a very important link to the civil rights movement, because Eckhart is very big on justice. He says, the person who understands what I say about justice understands everything I have to say. That from the greatest mystic of the West in terms of describing the experience. So Thurman goes on. These experiences of unity become over and over and over again more compelling than the concepts, the ways of life, the sects, and the creeds that separate people. It is my belief that in the presence of God, there is neither male nor female, white nor black, Gentile nor Jew, Protestant nor Catholic, Hindu, Buddhist, nor Muslim, but a human spirit stripped to the literal substance of itself before God. It is my simple faith that this is a kind of universe that sustains that kind of adventure. And what we see dimly now in the churning confusion and chaos of our tempestuous times will someday be the common experience of all the children of men and women everywhere. A beautiful vision of humanism. Thank you. May you be agents of that kind of wisdom.
Thank you. What we gifted today with the wonderful experiences, wonderful fun. Thanks.